And I have to say, first time I talked about this at the Weizmann, one of the professors there came up to me afterwards and he said, wow, that was almost a theory talk, which I think is like the best compliment they can give out there to non-theory talks. But what I want to tell you about is a technique that we call return-oriented programming. I should say that the name return-oriented programming is a joke. People who invent something new that they want to do with programming languages typically call whatever it is something-oriented programming. I'm not going to name examples, but people do. So this is return-oriented programming, but even though the name's a joke, I think the technique's actually useful, and in particular useful for breaking some widely deployed defense mechanisms. Okay, so this, I should say, is joint work with Eric Buchanan and Ryan Romer, who are here at UCSD, and Stefan Savage, who's another professor at UCSD. And I want to start with some philosophy. I want to tell you guys about what we do when we try to build defensive systems. And what we really do when we try to build defensive systems is we try to make things that we want to have happen, happen, and things that we don't want to have happen, not happen. So, for example, I want my web browser to go on web browsing. I don't want it to start sending out spam. And ideally, a defense mechanism would actually enforce that. It would say that it would know how to tell whether the behavior was something that a program should be doing, a system should be doing, or not, and react accordingly. But unfortunately, we don't really have any of those defense mechanisms, or they're not ready, or they're not deployed. And so people cheat. And the way that people cheat is they try to discriminate on the basis of code. They know what the browser's code looks like, and they think they have a pretty good idea of what this kind of like, if you exploited it and injected spam sending code, they have a pretty good idea of what that code looks like. And so they'll make a distinguisher that'll say, I'm going to allow application code, I'm going to allow good code, I'm going to allow the Xbox code, and I'm not going to allow bad code, I'm not going to allow Linux on Xbox, I'm not going to allow spam sending. And that's my defense. And from that distinction between good code and bad code, I'll get what I actually want. Because I don't care about good code, bad code. I care about good behavior, bad behavior. I care about spam, web browsing. And so what they say is, okay, that's fine because application code is good. The application is a web browser. It doesn't do spam sending. The attacker is going to inject this code that does the spam sending. So if I just rule that out, I'll also rule out bad behavior. So it doesn't really matter whether you rule out attacker code or not. It matters whether you rule out the bad behavior. And so this is, and I'll get to a list of these, this is what a lot of defense mechanisms do. They say, okay, I'm going to make sure that the attacker's code doesn't get introduced into my system. Nothing will ever live in my little system except the code that I put in there that I know is good. And that must mean that the bad behavior doesn't happen. If you can't exploit my web browser to inject code that causes spam to be sent out, then spam won't be sent out. So that's great. It also doesn't work. And I'll explain to you in this talk exactly why it doesn't work. And in fact, what I'm going to try to convince you of, the fundamental thesis of what I'm trying to talk about, is that if you start with any good code, if you start with libc or the web browser or Apache, that's a bunch of code that's already there, that's already trusted, that's already part of the system as it functions, and that's the good code. And the attacker can use that good code, doesn't introduce any new code. All he does is he takes little bits of that code that's already there, and he puts them together in new ways, and out comes any behavior that the attacker wants. And what that means is that the attacker, in particular, can take the web browser and use little bits of it without injecting any new code, without running any code that wasn't already in the process, use little bits of it to get the spam behavior that he wanted. So your defense mechanism might completely rule out any new code injection. It doesn't matter because that doesn't rule out the bad behavior. And there's a whole bunch of security systems that all are built around essentially this idea. And the most familiar one is probably WXOX, or as Windows calls it, DEP, Data Execution Prevention. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But there's a bunch of others. Trusted computing relies on knowing that you're booting a trusted kernel and that the kernel's booting a trusted application. The Xbox uses code signing to ensure that no untrusted applications are run. Tripwire and all these other systems use hashing to make sure that the binaries that are being run are okay. And all of these systems, and a bunch of other ones, all rely on having the good code be the good code, the code that has the right hash, the code that has the right signature, the code that is loaded into the system. And from that, they try to deduce that only good behavior happens. And again, our conclusion here is that that doesn't hold, that you can have good code all you want, and your system can still generate the wrong behavior. And I'll show you exactly how. So, as I said, this is a pretty general kind of attack, and it applies to a lot of different systems, but I want to focus specifically for a little bit on one specific defense, which is WXORX, which I mentioned before, and on returning to libc and how all these things interact, because this is where we come closest to kind of black hat turf. So, attackers really like to inject code, and operating system vendors don't really like to have buffer overflows exploited with code injection and all these things. So they got together and they came up with a really nice defense, which goes by the name WXORX, or as I mentioned, DEP in Windows. And this is now deployed on basically every operating system you have. And in fact, it needed hardware support on Intel processors, and Intel and AMD changed their processors to add hardware support. And the idea is that when we launch a process, we'll make sure that every page in the process's address space is writable or executable, but never simultaneously both writable and executable. And if that's true, then wherever it is that the attacker tries to inject code, writes new data, and tries to execute it, will fail, because either he was not able to write, in case it's executable, or he was able to write, but now he won't be able to execute. And so this is great, but attackers have a response to this too, which is the returning to libc attack, which dates back more than a decade now. And the idea is that, okay, we can't inject new code, we can't run code of our choosing, we're going instead to reuse functions that are already loaded into the program's address space, for example, in the C library, which is the traditional target. And here, just as I mentioned in the more general return-oriented programming attack, there's no code injection. So you just divert the control flow to system or to printf or to wherever it is that you want. And this was already known at the time that WXORX was widely implemented. So I always feel like asking the question, why did Microsoft go and implement DEP if they knew that attackers could now just run returning to libc attacks? Or why is this worthwhile? And the answer is, in part because there were other defenses, but also in part because there was a perception of the limitations of returning to libc, which is that returning to libc is weaker and less convenient than code injection. And it's weaker because you can't execute arbitrary code. You can call functions, and maybe you can call several functions one after the other, but you can't do branches. You can't do loops. And the other is that the attacker is more reliant on the system state as it's placed there by the defender. In other words, if I rely on my return into libc attack on the fact that the system function is there, and you realize that your Apache server never calls the system function, then you can just load a libc that doesn't have the system function in it, and now my attack is sunk. Now, maybe I can use some other variant of the attack, but I need to adapt. So return into libc is the response to WXORX, but it's weaker. So WXORX buys defenders something. It buys defenders the ability to weaken attackers, to make them not be able to do code injection, to do this return into libc thing instead, which is not as good. Okay, so our result, again, as translated specifically into the return into libc world, is that this perception is just wrong. It's just false. And return into libc is just as powerful as code injection. And in particular, if you give the attacker control of the stack, if you give him control of the control flow of your program, then he can effect arbitrary computation, arbitrary behavior, Turing-complete computation and behavior, using returning to libc-type techniques that don't rely at all on what's there in libc. So one way of looking at return-oriented programming is that it's a generalization of returning to libc, where, as I mentioned, you get Turing-complete exploitation, which means you're not straight-line limited. You don't just have to call one function after another. You can do branches, you can do loops, you can do everything else. It doesn't actually call functions, which means that you can remove the system function as a defender all you like, and it doesn't help you because the attacker still has exactly the same power. And in fact, I'll show later on the x86, it doesn't even rely on the things that your compiler put in libc. uses instructions that it finds in libc that you didn't intend to have there. So you actually could go and you could try to change the code issue portion of your compiler to try to defeat the attack, and you probably can't. So this is a very powerful attack, and it's just as powerful, really, as code injection. So I'll talk a bit about how the attacker would go about using something like this, how he would exploit a program in a return-oriented sense. And the way that he will is that he'll write up kind of, you know, whatever program it is that he wants to have implemented in some high-level language, and then he'll translate it. He could either use it, do this by hand, or I'll talk a little bit later about some compiler technology that he could use, into sort of fundamental instructions that encode what it is that he's trying to do. And then when you normally compile an assembly or assemble a program like this into an assembler, you translate each one of these symbols into an instruction. In other words, if you have this jump equal, then you'll use a jump equal instruction. Okay, well, the attacker won't be using instructions. He'll be using what we call gadgets. But there's going to be a gadget that does a load, a gadget that does a decrement, and so he'll translate this program that I have on the upper right into a set of these gadgets. And then he takes these gadgets and he lays them out on a stack. And what he ends up with is the actual exploit is going to look like the thing on the left. And what's there is a stack diagram that says you want to overflow the stack with these values, and a lot of the values on the stack are going to be pointers to instruction sequences in libc. And what will happen is that when, suppose this overwritten part of the stack is on the stack starting from where he's overflowed the return, the saved instruction pointer in a function, then because of the way these gadgets are constructed, the behavior that he actually wants that's expressed on the top left will actually happen by running these little snippets from libc without any code injection. So in other words, he gets the high-level behavior on the left just from programming the stack in this way. Okay. And in the context of returning to libc, it turns out that a lot of the building blocks that we use were actually already known. And so we needed just a little bit more on top of what was already known in the literature to get the full generality and the full Turing completeness. And I just wanted to point out some related papers. So, of course, the Solar Designer Return to Libc work from 97 shows how to do a single function that you want to call. Nergal, in his FRAC article, mentioned, among other things, how you can chain libc functions together. So, in other words, you're returning into one function, which returns into a second function, which returns into a third function. So that's already quite nice. And then Dark Spirit also showed what he called register springs, which are useful in Windows in particular, where you use these instruction sequences you want to interact through a register. And the thing is that on the x86, you actually look for these, and you don't necessarily have to find that actual instruction. You just have to find a byte somewhere that has that same encoding that you want. So that's already using unintended instructions, which I'll talk about in a little bit. And then Cramer really got quite close. I didn't actually know about this paper when I started this work, but this is really a great paper from 2005, where he showed that, again, you could chain these small snippets of instructions together to get quite sophisticated behavior, although he didn't point out the Turing completeness. Okay, and I'm not going to talk too much about how you actually use this in mounting real attacks, but it's fairly straightforward. All you really need is you need control of memory around the stack pointer. So if you have a buffer overflow on the stack, this is really trivial. Otherwise, you just have to move the stack pointer somewhere else. Okay, so I'll talk about specific gadgets that we build and exactly how they're built in a little bit, but I just want you to give you a sense for what the kind of the state of mind that you have is when you're doing return-oriented programming. And for that, we kind of have to think at a kind of lower level about how normal programming happens on normal processors. And the way that it works is that you've got a series of instructions in your text segment or your dynamic library, wherever it is. And then you've got this register called the instruction pointer that tells you what instruction you're going to go after next. And then the processor, because it's running, fetches an instruction that's in this memory location and then moves the instruction pointer so that it points to the next instruction. And it executes this instruction, and then it keeps going on, and the instruction pointer keeps moving forward. And if you want to affect control flow, if you want to do a jump or a branch or something like that, all you need to do is you need to change, have the instruction pointer go to some non-local location and not just be incremented to the next instruction, but jump somewhere else completely. Okay, so with return-oriented programming, we're going to do the same thing, but instead of the text segment, we're going to have the stack. And instead of the instruction pointer, we're going to have the stack pointer. So the idea is that the stack pointer always points to the instruction sequence. It's a sequence now. The instruction sequence that the processor is going to execute next. And then to get us started, the processor issues a return instruction. Why does the processor issue a return instruction? Well, imagine that the stack pointer points to where the processor thinks the saved frame, saved instruction pointer is of a function that we overflowed is. So it moves the stack pointer so it points here, like does a leave instruction, and then does a ret. Okay, so what that does is it increments the stack pointer, of course, and it fetches the instructions that are at the location pointed to in that word that we just popped, and it moves the instruction pointer there, and it starts executing them, and it'll just keep executing until something happens. Well, something is going to happen, which is that it's going to hit a return instruction. Every single sequence that we point to is going to be instruction, 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 return. And when it hits that return instruction, what it's going to do is it's going to say, oh, I have to do a return. Okay, I'm going to increment the stack pointer again. I'm going to take the address that I found at the word that I just popped. I'm going to use that as an instruction pointer, and I'm going to start executing there. So by having a bunch of these instruction sequences, each ending in a return, we get the stack pointer to move along, and the stack pointer really defines exactly where we are in the program. If we move the stack pointer non-locally back to the beginning of this chunk, then effectively we have a loop. So let's think about the very simplest case for how this happens, which is a no-op. So on the left, we have kind of the original normal programming world, and a no-op is just an instruction. Oh, it's 90, right? And so you have this one-byte instruction, and the instruction pointer is just going to be advanced because the processor says, okay, I need to fetch an instruction. Oh, look, it's 0x90. I'm going to treat it as a no-op, and I'm going to advance the instruction pointer by one. And you have many of these, and that's like a no-op sled. Okay, so in the return-oriented case, there's exactly the same thing. And what you do is you just point the address that's on the stack to some return instruction somewhere in executable memory, for example, in libc. Of course, there's tons and tons of these. And what's going to happen is that when the processor issues a return, it'll advance the stack pointer to the next word. It'll take the address that's there. Look, that's the address of a return instruction. It'll execute the codes there. It'll execute a return instruction. And then it'll keep doing the same thing. So each return instruction advances it along, but doesn't have any other effect. And so you get the equivalent of a NOP sled. Okay? Now, sometimes when you're encoding instructions in your program, you'll use constants. For example, suppose I want to set the EAX register to have the value dead beef. Okay, well, what that means is that I have this instruction that has 5 bytes starting in BB, and the 4 bytes after the BB are actually the little endian encoding of dead beef. So that value that I want to store in EAX is really right there in the instruction. So the processor fetches 5 bytes, and it says, oh, I have this first byte tells me that I have to treat the other 4 bytes as a value to move into the EAX register. Well, with return-oriented programming, we can do exactly the same thing. And what we're going to do is we're just going to say, we're going to put that next word that we want right there on the stack after the word pointing to the instruction sequence. And then when we start this instruction sequence, the stack pointer, because of the return that gets us started, will be advanced past that first word. So it'll be now be pointing to this dead beef word. And this pop EBX instruction will execute. And what that will do is it'll again advance the stack pointer. So it'll point past the end of that second word. And EBX will now have the value dead beef. So this way we can load values into registers really quite easily, right there off the stack. And again, I mentioned this before, we can do control flow just by controlling where the stack pointer goes. If we move the stack pointer all the way back to where we were when we started, that's a loop. If we somehow decide whether we want to move the stack pointer and then either move it or not, that's a branch. And so this works just the same way as control flow on the instruction pointer in normal programming. Although it turns out, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, it turns out that this is a little bit harder to affect because the programming constructs we have to work with aren't really that helpful for us. And I kept talking about instruction sequences, but before I talked about gadgets, and I said gadgets implement a single logical unit of behavior like a jump or an XOR or something like that. And the idea is that gadgets are kind of an intermediate organizational unit between these individual instruction sequences and the full program that you want to express. And a gadget might involve several instruction sequences. So for example, here is a gadget that implements a load from memory into a register. And the idea is that we have two instruction sequences here. The first one pops EAX from the second word. So now, by the time we get to the third word, EAX contains the address of whatever it is that we want to load over here on the right. And then the third word points to this load from EAX into EBX instruction, which moves the contents of this word to load into the EBX register. So by the end of these three words, what we've affected is that the EBX register contains this word in memory. We've loaded it into memory, into a register, and we also trashed EAX in the process, but we don't care. And we can treat this as a unit. We can just plop these three words anywhere in our program where we need to load from memory into a register. And we can just treat it as one load gadget. So a gadget is going to be a few instruction sequences all stuck together that give us the behavior that we want. So now for a while, I'm going to try to show you a few gadgets that we actually built for the x86. And these gadgets come from the libc that was distributed with Fedora Core 4. You could implement them just as well. They look a little bit different, but you could implement them just as well with any other libc on Linux. And we built gadgets that do everything, gadgets that do load store, gadgets that do arithmetic and logic operations, gadgets that do control flow, like loops, branches, and gadgets that do system calls. So anything that you want to express, you can express using these gadgets. And it's a little bit difficult to build, so some of these gadgets look kind of funny, specifically because these gadgets actually try to avoid the actual instruction sequences that were placed there in libc. I'll talk about that more in a bit. But I've been saying gadget for a while, and some of you might have kind of like fluffy kids' cartoons kind of associations with the word gadget. That's not really what I'm going for. I'm going more for like this kind of gadget. This, I guess, happened, 60 years ago, a few hundred miles east. I tried to get a picture of Oppenheimer standing next to it, but I guess they were smart and never let him get near the assembled device in case it went off prematurely. But anyway. So here's one of our arithmetic operations. This does a rotate. So if you look at the third word from the top, that's a bunch of zeros and a four. So what we want to do is we want to rotate the word down here at the bottom, this dead beef, left by four bits. And the way we're going to do that is in this stack diagram and in all the other x86 stack diagrams that you're going to see, the stack starts at the low memory addresses are on the bottom, high addresses are on the top. And the stack pointer, you can see ESP on the left there, points to the bottom. So we're going to start this. The processor issues a return, maybe because that lowest word there is where the saved instruction pointer used to be when we did our overflow. And so the processor does this pop EBX, which populates the EBX register with the address of this 0x deadbeef word at the bottom, minus this ridiculous constant that you see there on the left. That's only because if you look at the very top, we have this, what we're really aiming for is this rotate left logical instruction by CL of not actually the memory address by EBX, but the memory address by EBX plus some ridiculous constant. Why is that ridiculous constant there? It's just because that's the instruction that we found that we had to work with. But if we can control where EBX is, then frankly, we can make it be that value, wherever we want it to be, minus whatever constant. So it doesn't really matter. In any case, EBX now is this address minus whatever constant. And then we pop ECX and EDX. So ECX gets the value 0 through 4, which means that its lower order byte CL gets the value 4. And then it so happened that it was convenient to pop ECX and EDX together. So we pop EDX to a true statement, which is that decaf is bad, but we don't actually use that for anything. And then eventually we get this roll instruction, which actually does what we want. And in the end, decaf bad is rotated by 4 bits. And the stack pointer, it points to the very top of this, and that return after the rotate left starts us on whatever is the next gadget above us. So this is what these gadgets look like. If you look at the paper that's on my website, there's a whole bunch of these. But the one that I really want to highlight is kind of the most interesting one, which is the conditional jump operation. And this is really where the x86 instruction set makes things difficult for us. So the way that jumps normally work on the x86 instruction set is that a bunch of instructions as a side effect will set this eflags register. It's a pseudo register. You can't really access it directly. And then all the conditional jump instructions will say, well, is this particular flag set in eflags? If so, I'm going to jump. Otherwise, I'm not going to jump. So far, so good. And we can call those instructions. But when they say jump, they mean I'm going to move the instruction pointer around, because that's how control flow normally works. And that doesn't help us at all. We don't care about the instruction pointer. The instruction pointer just tracks these sequences until it finds the return. Then it goes to find the next sequence, does the return. So moving the instruction pointer around doesn't help in the least. So we really want to move the stack pointer around. But we're going to have to do that by hand, because there's no jump the stack if you see this. There's some other architectures like the Z80 that have conditional returns, but the x86 doesn't. So we had to develop a strategy, and the idea here was that we would go in several phases. So the first phase, we would say, okay, this eflags register, we can't manipulate it. It's not a useful register. We're going to use some dirty tricks to move the contents of eflags out to some register that we can actually control. And then now that register has maybe a 0 or a 1, depending on what we're trying to do. So we'll turn that 0 or 1 into some sort of delta. Suppose if the branch should be taken, then the stack pointer should be increased by 6 words. Then we want to compute the value 24 or the value 0. And then we'll apply that change to the stack pointer. Okay. So the first phase, we're just going to fill CF with some value that depends on something. So, for example, you could run this negate operation on EAX, and if EAX is not 0, then the carry flag CF is set. Otherwise, it's not set. Okay, that's easy. So this tells us whether EAX is 0 or not. Okay, now why did I pick the carry flag? Because the carry flag is there to support multi-word addition. So if I have two 64-byte values that I want to add to each other, then I have to add them 32 bits at a time on the 32-bit instruction set. And the way that I'm going to do that is I'm going to add the first two using the add instruction. And then there might be a carry. And that carry goes in the carry flag. And then when I add the higher order words, I'm going to add those, but I also want to bring the carry flag in. So Intel conveniently includes this instruction that you see right there, ADC, add with carry. And what that does is it adds the two operands plus the carry flag. And you can do this multiple times to add multiple words together. Okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to contrive through this, you can see this pop ECX business, we're going to contrive to have ECX have the value 0. Okay, so then this add with carry adds CL to CL and plus with carry, so that's 0 plus 0 plus carry, and it's going to store that into CL. And so 0 plus 0 plus carry is just whatever the value of the carry flag is. And so what we'll end up with is we'll end up in ECX with the value either 0 or 1, depending on what was in the carry flag. Okay? And then we do, in the last instruction there, we store that into memory in this word that we have down here at the bottom. Okay? And this is where it gets maybe a little bit ugly. But what we're going to do is we're going to turn that 0 or 1 into delta or 0. So you can see somewhere down there in the middle of that ladder diagram, you have this ESP underscore delta, and that's what we want. So if the branch should be taken, we want this carry flag word to contain ESP delta, and if the flag shouldn't be taken, we want it to contain 0. And this is the delta that we'll apply to the stack pointer when we want to jump around. Okay? And effectively, the way we're going to do this is a bunch of awful instructions, but the interesting parts are this negl instruction, which negates, does a 2's complement negation of a register, or in this case of memory. And what that's going to do for us is it's going to turn 0 into 0 because negative 0 is 0, and it's going to turn 1 into negative 1. Now, the interesting thing about 0 is it's represented by the all 0 pattern, and the interesting thing about negative 1 is it's represented by the all negative 1 pattern. Okay, so now we have a mask that's either all 0s or all 1s, and then we'll do this bitwise AND, this ANDL, which is pointed to by that other arrow. And what that will do for us is it will fill that word up again with either ESP delta or 0, because it'll AND either all 1s with ESP delta, which gives us ESP delta, or all 0s with ESP delta, which gives us all 0s. And once we have that, it's relatively easy to modify ESP. We just use this ADL of the value pointed to by EAX into ESP. And what that does for us is that it changes ESP by this value that we just computed. If it's 0, then nothing happens. We just continue along same as we were. If it's not 0, then ESP goes somewhere else, and we do a jump. So effectively, this is all kind of ugly, all kind of complicated, but if you put this together and you abstract it away as a gadget, then this gives us a gadget that lets us decide, based on whether the carry flag is set, which you remember was determined by whether EAX was 0 or not, whether we want to jump. And so this gives us a branch, and we can build all the other things that we want on top of this branch. And that's really the most complicated gadget out of all the gadgets that we build, but you can build ones that do everything. And so once you have gadgets that do everything, as I mentioned earlier, you can construct programs that do everything. So I want to say a few words about finding instruction sequences, because this is kind of cool on the x86. The idea is that we want to build these instructions, and the way we want to build these instructions is effectively instruction sequences. We want to look at what we have, look at what's available, look at what's potentially useful, and construct from that something that does what we want, construct that branch. And really, any instruction sequence that ends in a return and doesn't involve jumps or something else non-local is useful, or potentially useful. It might be useful in a gadget. So what we really want is we want, given libc or whatever other corpus we're starting with, we want to enumerate every single instruction sequence where you have a valid instruction, a valid instruction, a valid instruction, a valid instruction, and a return. And it turns out there's a really simple algorithm for doing this that works quite well. And the idea here is that you walk for libc from the beginning to the end as an array of bytes. And you walk and you say, hey, byte, are you a C3? Are you a return instruction? And at some point, you get to a return instruction. Okay, well, a return instruction is a valid instruction sequence ending in a return. It's not really terribly useful except as an op, but it's there. And then you start looking backwards. And you say, okay, is the one byte immediately before the return instruction also a valid one byte x86 instruction? If it is, then you could run that instruction, and then you would be the instruction pointer would be positioned for you right there to run the return, so you would have instruction return. But you can also ask, are the 2 bytes immediately before that instruction a valid 2-byte instruction? And that could very easily be the case because the x86 instruction set is prefix-free but not suffix-free. And in fact, I've seen cases where 8 different instruction lengths before a return are all valid instructions. So you ask, is the 2-byte instruction before the return a valid instruction? Is the 3 bytes before the return a valid 3-byte instruction? And so on up to the max instruction length. And these are all interesting instruction sequences. And once you've found an instruction sequence, you can start recursing back. And then you plop all of these into a data structure that does common suffix elimination, which is called a try. And the nice thing about the x86 instruction set is that x86 instructions are variable length and unaligned, which means that sometimes when you do this, you find instructions that weren't actually intended to be there by the compiler. So the amount of different kinds of instructions that you can run, the different instructions that you can use, is greatly increased, which is very nice for you as an attacker. I want to give you just one example, which is this ECB crypt function from GNU libc. And these are just 3 completely reasonable instructions that the compiler put in for us, which is it does this store, and then it does a test, and then it does a conditional set. I don't know why ECBcrypt needs to do these instructions, but it does. But the attacker doesn't care about these instructions. They're not actually all that handy. But what he does care about is that at the very end here, we've got a C3 byte. That's just part of the set NZB nonsense, but it's a C3 byte. So if you start the instruction pointer there, what you get is not, oh, look, I'm in the middle of a set NZB. You get a return. And it's worse than that. You have a whole series of instructions that are all there, all available for the attacker to use, that the compiler never intended. So even if your compiler is really careful about not emitting instructions that are going to be helpful to the attacker, it doesn't matter because the attacker is going to find those instructions in the middle of the other instructions. And this in particular has this very convenient store and some exchanges, all sorts of nice things. And this repeats over and over. Okay. So everything I've told you so far has really been about the x86. And if you've noticed, a lot of the things that we've been making use of, for example, just now, this business with variable length unaligned instructions, really are x86 specific. So I think it's a fair question to ask whether this applies to other instruction sets at all. And for example, if it doesn't, if it turns out that RISC instruction sets are not vulnerable to this, then maybe a good defense will be to turn the x86 instruction set into something that looks a lot more like RISC, which people have proposed. So the question that we want to ask and the question that Eric and Ryan really solved, and you should talk to them about, is return-oriented programming x86 specific, or does it apply elsewhere? And I give you the spoiler, the answer is it's not at all x86 specific, and we think it works everywhere. So let me just recall some of these features that we were really using when we were building the gadgets. So the x86 is... it doesn't have dedicated load store instructions. It's really a register memory machine, which means that if you think of a random instruction or you walk upon a random instruction just kind of poking around in libc, chances are that it manipulates memory. And this makes it very handy because you really kind of want to constantly be moving stuff around between registers and memory, and if you don't have to find dedicated load instructions, that helps a lot. X86 is also unbelievably register starved. There's really only about 8 general purpose registers, and few of them are actually used for doing computation. And that's actually very helpful because if you find two sequences that you kind of want to combine, it's very helpful if your register that gets loaded in on this sequence is the register that's used in this sequence. Whereas if you had 1,000 registers, the chances that that happens are going to be very small. So the fact that the x86 register starved really helps the original attack. I just talked about how the fact that the instructions are unaligned and variable length, and that this means that you can just pull out lots of instructions that weren't really intentionally there. And you have this very simple call return ABI. So you can really put things together in very simple ways that don't really look like the way that real functions use the stack. So all these assumptions are true on the x86. Basically, all of them are not true on RISC architectures. And in particular, Spark is probably the mainstream processor that looks least like the x86. It's a load store RISC machine. It has dedicated load and store instructions. It's got 128 registers, and 32 are available to any given functions. It has aligned instructions. Every single instruction is 32 bits long in 32-bit mode. And the processor enforces alignment on instruction fetches. That means that there's no such thing as an unintended instruction on a Spark. If you go into memory and you pull out 4 bytes, either those 4 bytes were the instruction that was placed there by the compiler, or you get a bus error. No unintended instructions. And to add to all this, you have this really hugely structured calling convention that uses register windows that I'll talk about more on the next slide. So basically, if return-oriented programming works on the Spark, and I'm going to show you that it does, then chances are that it's not something that's specific to the x86 or specific to the x86 and Spark. It's something that probably, unless we find something very specific in a specific architecture, probably applies across all architectures. And so what we did is we demonstrated that, in fact, return-oriented programming does work on the Spark. We used the libc that ships with Solaris 10, and the broadly speaking, the same techniques are used, but there were some new ideas that were really necessary that are Spark-specific, and I'll talk more about these in detail, but just initially, we have no choice but to use instruction sequences that are suffixes of real function. What do I mean by suffixes? Say a function in libc is a system, say it's 1,000 instructions long. Well, we said that we want a series of valid instructions ending in a return. Well, that means all of the 1,000 instructions in libc, sorry, in system, or the last 500, because the return is the last instruction, or the last 200, or the last 100, or the last 3. So those are really the only things we can use. We can't really use things that are in the middle of instructions because we need that return, and the return is really usually only at the end of a function. And because the calling convention on the Spark and the register use is really structured, we have to use a structured convention for moving data flow, moving data around within a gadget that kind of dovetails with that I'll show a little bit more later. And to avoid having to have gadgets depend on each other, we actually make everything go through memory. So whereas you saw that some gadgets that I showed before for the x86 relied on, oh, EAX is preloaded with this value, that never happens. All gadgets load from memory and write to memory at the end. And so return-oriented programming is possible on the Spark. We think it's possible on every architecture. And now I'm going to drill down more into the details of the Spark. So the Spark has, as I mentioned, 128 registers. These are in these banks. There's global registers, and then there's these banks of out registers, local registers, and input registers. And when you do a call save or a ret restore, the window is shifted. And so when one function calls another function, it gives its arguments in its output registers, and then it does the save, the call save, and the register window is shifted, and all of a sudden, those output registers are now this function's input registers, and this just keeps going. And I should mention the Spark is kind of a backwards architecture, kind of like in Australia, everybody walks backwards, so on the Spark, they like to have high memory at the bottom and low memory at the top, so all the diagrams are kind of backwards. But in any case, there's this very structured way that you use the stack, and your frame pointer is going to be I6, that is input register 6. Your own stack pointer is going to be O6. You can see that when the call happens and then the restore happens, the old frame pointer becomes the current stack pointer. Return address is stored in I7. And then there's this register save area that goes on the stack. So the data flow strategy that we adopt is that a sequence is going to, we're going to have a bunch of sequences, and they're going to be sequenced. They're going to by these returns, one after the other. And so on a restore, the input registers from the first sequence are now the output registers of the second sequence because we had this ret restore. And so the first sequence is going to have to write stuff into the input register, and the second sequence is going to have to read from that output register, the matching one. And sometimes that doesn't work. Sometimes, for example, if you need to carry two values, there's not a convenient way to do that. And so what you do is you write into the stack frame that's going to be resurrected way up at the top, and I'll show how that works. And for the Spark, we build gadgets that implement basically every operation ever. So there's loads, stores, indirect loads, indirect stores, assignments. We have function calls, so we can actually call functions in libc. We have system calls, so we can directly call a trap into the kernel. We have every math logical operation you want and all these control flow operations. And I'll give a few examples. So one example is addition. And the way you should think about this diagram is that the assembly on the right tells you what instruction sequences are going to be executed. The preset column on the left says what in the stack frame that is resurrected when this frame is returned into, we care about. We set everything, but we care about this. And on the left, there's just sort of a pseudocode that tells you what this does. So what we do is we set the I0 register to point to V2, which is this variable on our variable location. And the assembly in the first instruction sequence does a load from the memory at I2 into L6. So all of a sudden, L6 now contains the memory that we care about. And then it does a store of L6 into the address pointed to by L7, which we point into this I0 two frames later. And then we repeat the same thing, loading variable 3 into I3 two frames later. So we're writing into memory on the stack. And then by the time this third instruction sequence, this add instruction sequence, is called, the ret restore that brought it into the processor also caused the I0, I3, I4 registers to be read in from the stack with the values that we wrote for them. And so it'll do the add and then store I5, which computes the sum, into the this variable V1. And the effect of this will be that the variables V2 and V3 will be added together and stored in V1. And the branching you can actually see is a little bit simpler than the branching on the x86. Effectively, everything that we're going to do is going to load into this I6 register in the last frame either the target T1 or the target T2. Now, I6, remember, is the frame pointer, or rather the I guess by that point it's the stack pointer. And so when you do a ret restore, effectively all the ret restores happen with what we would think of on the x86 as a frame pointer, so like a leave ret. And so that will change the stack pointer to point to either either T1 or T2, which will make it jump. And the way that we'll actually cause that value to be computed as either T1 or T2 is through this third from the bottom instruction sequence, this branch equal. So we'll load a bunch of values, we'll compare them in the third instruction sequence, and then we'll branch equal. And we'll branch equal one ahead, so we'll branch to that ret. Now, that you might think that what this will do is it'll cause that second line, that subtraction, to be skipped. But no. No. On the Spark, you have a delay slot before jumps, and that delay slot is wrong even if the jump happens. So jumping one ahead doesn't actually buy you anything because it's the same, that second instruction is always executed by the time you jump ahead. So regardless of whether you take the jump or not, you end up executing the same code. So that's not actually useful, but it is because of this comma A, which is a branch annulled. And that means that if the branch is, I always forget, not taken, then the delay slot is not executed. And this means that I0 will either compute T2 if the branch is not equal, because it won't be changed, because that instruction will be skipped, or it'll compute T1 minus 1 minus negative 1, which is T1. Okay. So you can go to our paper and look at all these branches, and that's all fun, but it's no fun to write these on your own, and it's no fun to write these even if what you get is shellcode. So this is an example of x86 shellcode. It's basically just the Aleph 1 shellcode translated to return-oriented programming. It effectively goes through this lcallgs, which goes into the Linux sysenter. So I went and I did this by hand, and I figured out exactly what instruction sequences I want for my shellcode, and I coded up a shellcode, and I was careful to make sure that there's no 0 bytes. And then it turns out that if you have a target that has a buffer overflow on the stack, then you can run this against this target, and out pops a shell. So, I mean, it's great because you get shellcode, but it's not really a lot of fun to hand roll your own. And so we've got kind of a better option for you. So the better option has an API that allows you to say, well, okay, I want a string that has the content bin sh, and then I want to assign an address, and then I want eventually to do this gsyscall, which traps into the syscall that affects the shell. And so you write this gadget, all these gadgets together, and then you compile this into a program, and you also describe, well, the vulner application is called demo-vuln, and it's in this directory. And it's in the vulnerability requires that I trash 336 bytes on the stack, and so on. And you run this through the compiler, and out comes a new program, exploit, over here. And you run this, and exploit execs this vulnerable target, and it creates an egg to overflow the stack, and then it also has in the environment array the actual gadgets, and everything gets automated for you, and out pops a shell. So in other words, you can write whatever program you want by just sequencing these gadgets in this API that we give you. You compile, and then you run the exploit. It exploits the program, and you get the code that you want to run. And this particular shell code is about 1,000 bytes or 1,200 bytes. Okay, so that's kind of nice. But it's still kind of a pain because you have to like deal with this API and you're compiling in C. What you really want is you want to write in a high-level language. Like that first example that I gave you, remember at the top left, the attacker was writing in this high-level language and all this other translation happened, but the attacker doesn't care. He doesn't want that. He just really wants to say, well, you know, I've got binsh, that's going to be something, and I need something that points to it and then points to null because I need this like arg array, and I need an env array, and then I want to do a trap. So this is what I want to write, not this other crap, and certainly I don't want to do it by hand. Well, okay, we can do that. So we've got this compiler that compiles down to the gadget API, and you write your exploit in this compiler, like these four lines, and you run it through, and out comes this program that executes the vulnerable program, and you get a shell. Works just as before. And this is much easier to write. And it's not just that it's easier to write, it's that it allows you to write much more sophisticated attacks that really make use of the full power that you're given. So one example that I wanted to give you here is a selection sort. And so this is a program, it's so complicated that it's going to take three screens, but it's written in this gadget programming language that we've built. And the idea is we'll, you know, seed random, and when I say seed random with time, I mean this actually calls those functions in libc because we have a function called gadget. And then we'll allocate some memory. And then we'll walk through this array and initialize each of the elements of this array out of random. And then we'll even print them out. Okay, and then we'll actually walk through and we'll do a selection sort. So this is going to be a for, and then for each I, and then it's going to keep track of a minimum. It's going to walk j along the array inside that, so we've got nested loops. And then if we're smaller than the minimum, we're going to keep track of that. And then at the bottom, we're going to do the swap. So this is just like from programming 101, this is selection sort, and we're implementing it. And then once we're done with that, we'll say, okay, you know, we've got the sorted array, and here it is. And we'll even, you can see this here, the last line here, frees memory. So this is intended to be an exploit that runs inside a program that's been taken over, but it's very nice about, very polite about freeing memory that it mallocs, it doesn't have memory leaks. And so you actually compile this through, you get a program called selection sort. That program has a 24 kilobyte payload with 152 gadgets, 381 instruction sequences, all placed there for you by the compiler. You don't need to do anything, you don't need to know anything. And then it executes this vulnerable target program, gives it this egg that overflows its stack, and then when that egg is carried through the processor, you get the selection sort behavior. So we have the unsorted array printed out, and then the sorted array. And all of this happens, again, I should say, with no code injection whatsoever. The processor just does its thing. And this is all nicely automated. So to wrap up, and then I guess we have time for questions. What I want to have you take from this is not so much the details of exactly how these gadgets work. You can always look at the paper, or ideally, you know, once we make our compiler available for download, just use the compiler and not even care how it works. What I want to demonstrate is that if you have completely arbitrary behavior, including for some reason you want to run selection sort, then you don't actually need code injection to do that. No matter how complicated or how sophisticated your attack is, you can do it by just leveraging code that's already present in the program's address space. Now, typically people don't need to do exploits that are that sophisticated because they'll just use them as a stage to do something else, and that's fine. That doesn't mean that you have to now rewrite everything to be return-oriented. It just means that any defense that assumes that at some point the attacker injects bad code is a useless defense. So WXORX doesn't buy you a single thing. When AMD and Intel went and they implemented the NX bit or the XD bit, whatever they call it, in their processors and check that their page table implementation is now better. It didn't break anything. That was millions of dollars of R&D that they used up. Didn't buy them anything. So any defense that you run across where it says, I can distinguish between good code and bad code, and therefore I can distinguish between good behavior and bad behavior, and rule out bad behavior, that doesn't apply. And it doesn't apply not just on x86, but really we think on every single architecture. But definitely, for sure, at least x86 and Spark, which probably means every x86 and RISC instruction set. And this is kind of a pain to do, but it's kind of a pain to do basically once. And once you do that, you can automate it, as we've seen, and you can automate it to build arbitrarily complicated exploits that you just write very simply that compile for you and really make this, we think, a very practical, usable attack. So the original paper on this for the x86 appeared at the CCS conference last year. The paper that extends it to Spark and talks about the compiler will appear at CCS this year, actually. It's been accepted, but this is the first time that we're talking about it, so I hope you enjoyed it, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Had to wait to get out. Let's take some questions. Go ahead, sir.
So I'd like to know how does ASLR fit into this, because it seemed that one of your assumptions was that you could find within libc specific addresses
right.
that you could read to, right?
Yeah, so this doesn't deal with ASLR. So you either need to be able to brute force where libc is, which if you don't need to know where the stack is, you might be able to on 32-bit platforms, or you need some other leak that somehow tells you where libc is, or some sort of way of injecting something that's small that somehow finds that information out for you. But this does not at all address that. And if you do have ASLR, then the attack, as simply described, just doesn't work because you're not going to be able to find libc, especially in 64 bits. The kind of arguments is these things are kind of orthogonal, right? I mean, if you have ASLR alone and you didn't have WXORX, then a lot of these other things like code injection also don't work if you don't control where things are. So in a sense, the ASLR on its own would have been good, modulo its limitations.
Yes, quick comment on a question. Comment is probably you only need one program to compile, which is disable dep, and then you're done. And the question is, it's also dependent on the version of libc, right? Because it may
Absolutely.
Some instruction series or subsets may change over different versions.
Right. Right. So, in fact, because you rely on the presence of specific instruction sequences, if somehow the version of libc that ships with computers changes and those instruction sequences are not there, you have to do the work again of building the gadgets. So there is a question of how often these change. Of course, you could change them artificially in the compiler. You could compile your own libc and re-randomize where the functions are to just do things on your local machines. To some extent, this is an argument really for saying that you don't want exactly the same code shipping on every machine everywhere. And I'm sure we've had lots of arguments in this direction before. This is just one more example that says that, yes, absolutely, to the extent that the attacker can tell what binaries you're running on your computer, that's really not good for you. Another point is that so far, what we have is we actually build this by hand. So in other words, we actually go and we take the libc and we pull out all the usable instruction sequences and we decide, like, how will we implement a branch today? And so that's clearly not scalable if, every single point release of Windows completely recompiles MSVCRT. We think that this is actually automatable, and we're working towards automating it. And at that point, the attacker just needs to get a copy of your libc and run this automated gadget builder on it. But we're not there yet.
I have one up here, sir.
Just a question about your conclusion that WriteX or execute is useless. If you have WriteX or execute and a heap buffer overrun, would this help you at all?
Well, you need to control the stack pointer. So the question is just whether you can make that register point where you want it. The way that I normally envision that is if you can overwrite a program's, some function pointer in the program. For example, maybe there's data on the heap if you're doing heap data overflows, or maybe if your heap still allows, I guess the heap is less likely to allow metadata overflows if you have ASLR. But if you can do that and then cause the stack pointer to move somewhere, then that helps. But again, ASLR on its own is kind of a defense. Sorry. Okay, so we're not ASLR. So the idea is if we know how the stack is configured, then if we have a heap overflow, then we should be able either to overwrite a function pointer if we do feng shui, or overwrite metadata that will allow us to do a write for somewhere else. And if we can do a write for of a function pointer, and that function pointer is called, then the code that will execute will say, move this other value, for example, some other register, into the stack pointer. And then we can just move the stack pointer over to the heap. And if we can do that, then we're in control again. So in a sense, we don't really need to overwrite the stack. We just need to make the stack go to where we control. So I hope that answers the question.
Hi. Very interesting presentation. Thank you very much. I have a quick question. Do you think GS flag would prevent such an attack?
Well, if I'm right, that's the Microsoft / GS effectively stack overflow protection. So with the attacks that I just described, the way that we're taking control is we're overriding a buffer overflow on the stack. So absolutely it would protect against this. But in a sense, it would also protect against normal code injection in the absence of WXRX, against that specific overflow. So it's kind of, again, I think of it as orthogonal. If you have somehow a way of getting around / GS so that you can overwrite some, you do a write for, overwrite some memory somewhere, then you should be able to use these techniques also to get around WXRX. But if you don't have a way of getting around / GS, then this doesn't help.
Yeah, how much bigger are the return-oriented payloads compared to conventional payloads?
On the x86, they can be packed pretty tight. My shell code was 64 bytes and had no zeros. So that's like, you know, a factor of, what, 3 over the standard shell codes. If you're using gadgets that are kind of inconvenient, like branches, then there's more of a blow-up. But I think for most of the things you want to do, they're pretty reasonable. And you can always use a staged loader, I think.
Any more questions, please? I thought it was interesting. Now, this is relatively new, isn't it?
Yeah, so about a year ago.
Yeah, I'm happy. Any other questions from anybody else? Thank you.
Sorry, it's just a comment, answering some question. Over there. You don't need to make all your payload return-oriented, just the first portion that disables step, and then you're done.
Absolutely. If all you need to do, if the operating environment allows you to turn off DEP or turn it off for a particular memory region, then absolutely. Then you can have a very small payload that does this. There are some embedded operating systems where all the code has to be loaded from ROM and there's no way to turn off DEP. In that case, everything needs to be this way. But yeah, if you have some way of turning stuff off to make things more exploitation easier, then you definitely want to do that.
Have you done any work with stacker link binaries and getting some rules of thumb on the sort of order of magnitude of complexity you need to get a Turing-complete gadget set?
We haven't. I've looked at some, just basically dumped out the instruction sequences that I find and kind of eyeball to decide whether I think that I'll be able to do things. It seems like 300 kilobytes is plenty. But I don't absolutely know that for a fact. We're working on trying to build an automatic tool that will try to find these sequences and put them together. And at that point, we're going to just dump a whole bunch of binaries off SourceForge and try to see what happens. But I don't know yet. I expect it's in the hundreds of kilobytes. Definitely everything that I've looked at that was a megabyte or more, there was plenty of stuff that we could build from.
Any other questions? Great subject. Pick his brain while he is here.
Thank you
so
much.